Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of White Coast Real Talk. Today we're talking about one of the most remarkable procedures in medicine, liver and kidney transplantation in adults and children. Every year, thousands of adults in the US wait for a second chance at life, a liver transplant that could save them. But the numbers tell a sobering story. More than 80,000 people are on the waiting list, and only about 1 in 10 will receive a liver this year. Still, for those who do, survival rates continue to rise, thanks to the remarkable advancements in surgery, organ preservation, and living donation.
That's where today's guest comes in. We're joined by Dr. Mark Melcher, Chief of the Division of Abdominal Transplantation at Stanford University and former Program Director of the Stanford Abdominal Transplant Surgery Fellowship. He's at the forefront of adult liver and kidney transplantation. Dr. Melcher's work combines precision in the operating room with innovation in research, from improving donor recipient matching to exploring new ways to expand the organ pool through living donation and technology. Beyond his clinical expertise, he's also deeply committed to training the next generation of transplant surgeons and improving outcomes for patients across the world. Together, we'll explore how science, compassion, and innovation are reshaping what it means to get and give the lift of a liver and kidney transplant. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Melcher. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on the show. I started my day pretty early in the morning today and was in the hospital for most of the day, so this is a nice change of pace. So,
Well,
thank
yeah,
you.
we're super excited to have you on our episode today. And so just to start off the episode, for families and patients hearing the word transplant for the first time, what does a liver transplant really mean and what does it entail, whether it's for a child or an adult?
Yeah, so your liver is super important for many, many functions in your body. And so a lot of people, even with liver disease, be walking around doing fine. But the problem is it's also very important for when your body has to ramp up in stressful health situations. So a lot of people with liver disease will be doing fine, looking fine, and then all of a sudden sort of fall off the cliff if they get sick. For children, it's a little bit different. There's several different types of diseases for children that include both something called biliary atresia, which is something where their bile ducts don't form properly. There are metabolic diseases for kids where they have maybe a genetic mutation or something where they can't make a key enzyme, for example, something in the Krebs cycle or something like that. Or there can be something called acute liver failure where something stimulates them to completely lose the function of the liver and they go into fulminant failure. And that's when they go into full liver failure, that's a life-threatening situation almost immediately.
That sounds very scary. And so, regarding children and adults, I'm sure their livers are different. So, how are the differences in liver diseases? How do they show up differently between children and adults? And what are leading reasons that children or adults need for a liver transplant?
Yeah, so starting on the adult side first, a lot of people in the past, we worried about viral diseases, hepatitis C, hepatitis B. There have been some incredible advances in the medications for these diseases over the last decade and a half, and really remarkable. It used to be most of our patients that we transplanted were for hepatitis C cirrhosis. They were at risk of not only getting cirrhosis, which is massive scarring of the liver, but also liver cancer. Same for hepatitis B. They also were put at high risk of liver cancer and getting scarring of the liver. But these amazing medications that came out with widespread use in basically around 2013 have really reduced the complication rates from these diseases and are able to cure hepatitis C completely. Alcohol has been sort of a continuous cause of liver scarring and cirrhosis. That, see, to our sort of in a non-scientific way, seemed to get worse during the COVID pandemic. It seemed like more people were drinking at home, and we saw a lot more cases of alcohol-related liver failure. You can get both long-term scarring of the liver from alcohol disease, or you can get acute liver failure from very heavy drinking. There's also non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and there are groups of people that are predisposed to just having fatty liver disease. There's groups of diseases with like diabetes and high blood pressure. Those patients can be at high risk of fatty liver disease. And then a portion of those patients go forward to being having scarring. There are a lot of people out there with fatty liver disease that never go forward and get cirrhotic and scar, but they're a portion of them. And a lot of science being done now to try to predict which of those patients move forward. Going back to kids, it's a little bit different, right? So there, the diseases are the most common is the biliary atresia that we talked about. That's where the something happens that's that they're not able to form bile ducts, so they can't drain bile. So these kids turn bright yellow and get scarring of the liver. And they we can talk about the disease process there, but early diagnosis is key there because there are some surgical procedures that you do before the liver transplant that can actually help those patients out and do better. Then there's metabolic disease where there's a genetic defect somewhere in some sort of biochemical cycle, like the Krebs cycle, where they can't clear certain amino acids and stuff. And those mutations can cause long-term developmental delays in kids. So getting a liver, they actually, much of the liver functions normally. And actually, when we do the transplant, their liver looks normal a lot of the time. But it's a very specific mutation they have. And by giving them a new liver with a wild type version of that gene, they can now process and complete like the Krebs cycle appropriately.
So obviously transplantation is like a very drastic step. So what actually happens to get to this point and needing like a transplantation? And what matters like more early on? Is it the labs or what you see at the bedside when you're interacting with patients?
Yeah, so of course it's different in adults versus kids. So if you look at a biliary atresia, it turns out if you do screening tests for that include like a bilirubin and stuff early on in life, and you can screen kids for the likelihood of them having biliary atresia. Of course, very few kids actually do, so you have to screen thousands of kids first. So you need to be willing to invest in that screening system to do that. If you can identify them early, they can undergo what's called a Kasai procedure, which is a general, what usually general surgeons, pediatric general surgeons do, where they are able to sew a portion of the child's small bowel to the liver directly so the bile is able to drain. Classically, one third of those work, one third of those work for a while, and one third of those fail. So first, for options two and three, there eventually they need a liver transplant. But the benefit of this procedure is that they're able to grow. And you know, I can imagine a 4 kilogram baby is a very difficult liver transplant. So the larger the child, the easier it is to do the transplant, and probably the complication rate goes down as you grow the child.
So just a quick question. If you find it earlier on, would you wait until they get a little bit bigger to do the transplant, or would you just do it like as early as possible to minimize complications?
So if they're doing okay, even if you know they're a little bit sick, you might wait. Like we like to wait till if they're, you know, 9 or 10 kilograms if we can. We can't always, but so we like to wait till the 9 or 10 kilograms. Sometimes you're forced to go earlier because what can happen, like I said, if you have a cirrhotic scarred liver, if you get sick, get a viral infection or something, you can get really sick quickly and you may not survive if you don't get a transplant sooner. So
I see. And so many children and adults in the US receive liver and kidney transplants. Like they never get the chance because they are referred too late. So from your perspective, what are the signs a doctor could say it's time to start a transplant? And if you had two patients, how would that go into finding a transplant as the waiting list is very long for people?
yeah, so clearly early diagnosis and early referral to a specialist is key. And that it's not just because you're going to give them a transplant, but it's also it requires intensive care and you know nutrition is super important. Like I said, like you guys pointed out, it's better to grow the child a little bit first. So if they're referred into the medical system where they can get the supportive care, like nutrition and education, all those things are important for long-term success. So not only is the early referral important to possibly get a transplant sooner, but it also is to prepare for a transplant because it's a major undertaking, obviously, to get a transplant. And success entails not just a surgery that goes well, but it entails the parents and the caregivers really understanding what to look out for complications. It entails making sure that they have the support system to come back for follow-up visits. So it's a huge undertaking from multiple aspects, not just the surgeons, not just the hepatologists, but also the nurse coordinators, the nutritionist, the physical therapist, the pharmacist. All these people are involved. It's amazing how many people are involved in any individual transplant.
Yeah, with all the doctors we talked about, they really say that teamwork's very important, and like all the specialties coming together. It's really amazing that how they all come together and help a person out. And so for matching and getting a donor, I think families wonder where actually the new liver comes from. Could you explain like the difference between a living donor, a diseased donor, and like maybe split liver transplants?
Yeah, so we can start with living donation, and living donation percentage wise is probably more common in children. So when you're trying to find a liver, first of all, most of the time you try to match the blood type. O to O, A to A, B to B, and so forth. Then for kids, size becomes very important. Again, partly because we talked about this, you want to grow the kid longer to larger size. But a tiny kid cannot, there are very few, luckily, there's very few small pediatric donors, right? So you might take a portion of the liver. So you can donate two-thirds, up to two-thirds of your liver to somebody else. That's not without risk, and it's heroic for people to donate, but it is possible, and that your liver will regrow to full size within a few months. It's pretty dramatic. But so for a kid, you can give the left lobe of a liver to the ch to a child, and they can do very well. And the it turns out the outcomes are as good as deceased donation, and in some cases maybe better. There, it's not without complications, but it's a really good option, especially when size really matters, because you only need a small portion of the liver. The living donation requires somebody to volunteer to step forward. It does entail some risks. They do get anybody who's donating a living donor, they get fully worked up, they get scanned, they get blood tests, and we try to do no harm to the donors, right? So we really want to protect the donors and make sure that it's safe for them to donate. Another strategy is deceased donation. And again, it's an incredibly dramatic story, right? There's a tragedy that happens out there. A family's going through the worst day in their life. A loved one, whether an adult or a child, has died, and they've got to decide and think outside themselves there for, which is so hard in that situation, to donate this to save other lives. A procurement team goes, procure the organs, and brings them back to our hospital. There you have an opportunity. If you have a child on the list and an adult on the list, you can actually split that liver, give again the left lobe or part of the left lobe to the child, and the remainder of the lobe to the adult. We have a very active pediatric transplant program here at Stanford, and we have a long list on both sides. So we've done that a few times where we've taken a deceased donor liver, split it, and give it to two people. Which is fantastic, right? It's an amazing story when that goes well. And so there's the, that's where splitting comes in. Splits are sort of similar to living donation because you're taking only a portion of the liver to give to each person.
Yeah, that's truly showed us like just how important organ donation is. And you mentioned that donations for children specifically, like it's much more rare, which is very good, thankfully. But since there's such a small amount of them available, how is fairness maintained in organ allocation?
Great questions. It's interesting. For different types of organs, there's different principles on who's prioritized. So just to give a counterexample, in kidney transplantation, you have dialysis. If your kidney's not working, you can be on dialysis, right? And people on dialysis can have, it's a pain in the butt. It's three times a week for 3 or 4 hours a day. So it really can be intrusive in their lives, but there's a lot of very successful people who are on dialysis and, even working and having productive lives. So in kidney transplant, it's wait time. How long you've been on the waiting list is the dominant factor that determines what your priority is on the list, because you're not going to die tomorrow because you don't have a kidney, because you can have dialysis. For liver transplant, there's no equivalent to dialysis. And so the priority is given primarily based on how sick you are and what's the likelihood of you dying in a certain amount of time if you don't get a liver transplant. And the sickest patients are transplanted first. In children, because the diseases are so different from each other, biliary atresia, you look very sick. The metabolic disease, you may not look so sick. It's hard to compare. It's like comparing apples to oranges, right? It's hard to compare these blood tests from this type of disease to these blood tests from this type of disease and say who is the sicker patient. So there's always lots of discussions about this, and we try to be as transparent as possible about this. But there's a scoring system where they get a score. It's called a PELD score, and they get a score that prioritizes them on the list. In some cases, the PELD score is determined by your blood test. In some cases, the PELD score is determined by your disease and how sick you are. So, based on some other even more subjective terminology, but the PELD score becomes your final arbitrator of who's the sickest. And there's always modifications to the PELD score to try to make sure it's fair. And basically, you're always weighing fairness, which you guys rightly brought up, with utilitarianism, right? So you want to be fair, but you also want to be efficient to get as many people as transplanted as possible. Sometimes they come counter to each other a little bit, because if you want to be really utilitarian and efficient, you might not be as fair versus vice versa.
For sure. I can only imagine how there might be some disputes on situations like this, but there's obviously a fair system, and that's what works. But moving on to some like everyday choices that could affect your liver. If a family wants to act after hearing this podcast, what's one realistic first step they can take together for their liver health?
So it turns out, it's easier for me to say in adults because
Go ahead.
in adults, it turns out healthy living is probably good for your liver also, right? So, clearly alcohol contributes heavily. It's one of the, alcohol, actually, if you look at all causes of death in the United States, alcohol is probably one of the biggest contributors of all, and not just because of liver disease, but also because of car accidents and stuff like that. But, it's indisputable that heavy drinking over prolonged periods of time is not good for your liver. But also eating well, exercising, making an effort to maintain your weight at a reasonable weight. So all those things contribute to liver health. I wouldn't get caught up in, sometimes you see ads for liver health cocktails or something like that. I wouldn't get caught up in that. I would focus on what we all know are good for you: exercise, eating healthy, avoiding lots of saturated fats, eating lots of vegetables, and a well-balanced diet, and getting regular exercise.
Can you please take us to surgery now? So, what really happens from the first time that the call comes in for a transplant to the time the new liver starts working? How long is that process, and what happens after the transplant finishes, and how long do you have to be in recovery for?
Yeah, so this is one of the reasons why I'm in this field. It's like I mentioned earlier, it's a dramatic story from beginning to end. So someone passes away, their family makes the decision to donate. Then what we have is a donor network throughout the United States. They approach the family saying, "Are you willing to do this?" And they're trained people. They know how to approach the family in a respectful way, to ask them without pressuring them, but sort of telling them the benefits of transplant. Once the family agrees, those organs go into UNOS, which is the national organization for organ sharing, and there's all these criterias for these lists, right? Based on regional, where it is in the country, and on various issues. And so then the computer produces a list of patients that are being offered. Then all the individual centers are notified if they have a patient on that list. And we go through, say, "I will take it for this person, I won't take it for this person," and we say yes or no, and then whoever is on the highest on the list gets it next. And so then I get a phone call saying, "This is being offered to patient so and so. Do you want this?" And I look through the medical history of the donor. I say yes or no, depending how far away it is, when it'll get to me, and stuff like this, and whether I think it's a good match for my patient. We call the patient in. The donation, often we send a team to go procure the organs. Sometimes now, more and more so, local teams procure the organs and send the organs to us. We go to the operating room. A liver transplant takes about 8 hours or so, 5 to 8 hours including time to go to sleep and wake up after the surgery. One of the functions of livers is to make blood clotting factors. And obviously, they're going in with liver failure, so they're not clotting very well. So there can be lots of bleeding. We can transfuse, between a few units of blood to well over 30 units of blood in some situations. So it can be a pretty difficult operation. They almost always go to the ICU afterwards. They're in the ICU for 2 or 3 days. For us, the median time in the hospital is about 10 days for adult patients. It's longer for kids. Probably 2 to 3 months before most patients wake up in the morning, not thinking about the liver transplant as the first thing of the day. That takes a while. But it's really great to see, because these patients are on death's doorstep, right? They're the sickest patients in the hospital. They get this liver transplant, and often they're confused, they're bright yellow, but within a week or so, the yellowness is going away, their mind is clearing up, they're able to converse. It's a really dramatic picture, and a really a testament to the impact donors have on lives, right? And one donor can give 2 kidneys, a liver, 2 lungs, a heart, skin, corneas. One donor can really impact, 7+ lives. And it's just, yeah, it's great to see them in the hospital. So one thing that happens, it's kind of interesting, they go to the ICU after surgery, they look extremely sick, they wake up a little bit, and then they get transferred out of the ICU. So those ICU nurses don't get to see the benefit of their hard work in the ICU. So what I've done in the past is take pictures of my patients, 3 months later, and show slideshows to the ICU nurses so they see the impact of their positive work.
It's very wholesome.
And the best is if that patient goes and visits them on the floor and they're like, "Wow, you're blowing me away, how great you look." And hopefully they're working again, they're contributing to society, they're taking care of other family members. So it's a really nice story.
That's definitely very inspiring. And I imagine the ICU nurses are very grateful to be able to see the patients that they've worked like extremely hard on.
Yeah, it's great to see.
Yeah, for sure. And along those lines, do you have any specific, or not specific, but patient stories that have stayed with you or resonated with you throughout your years and your career in transplantation?
Yeah, many, many stories. And one that sticks out is, and it covers sort of all the topics that we had today. She was transplanted as a young child, I think within the first year of life. And I don't remember what it was exactly, but maybe it was biliary atresia or something like that. And she did very well. She went through high school. She got into dance. She was a semi-professional dancer. She got into her 20s, and then she started suffering from chronic rejection. And chronic rejection is this strange sort of disease where there's sort of fibrous, the liver becomes fibrous again, and maybe it's from prolonged micro rejections, or maybe it's from the medications, or maybe it's not so clear always. But she started suffering from that and started getting very sick. And in fact, sometimes with liver failure, you also get kidney failure at the same time. So sometime in her 20s, she went back on the list, and we received an offer late at night that got turned down for other reasons elsewhere. So I went and talked to her, and I said, it's going to be on ice for a little bit longer than usual, but I think this will work. I think we can do, and I think we can give you both a kidney transplant and a liver transplant at the same time. And we went for it. And doing a retransplant's hard because you got a the liver is stuck in there much more so than the first time around. And so she was in the hospital for a little bit, and but eventually got out of the hospital, and it just started thriving again. She's just embracing the second chance at life, and she picked up dance again. I think she was teaching it rather than actually doing it semi-professionally. At one point, I told her I needed a picture of her for this talk and within minutes, she texted me a picture of her and her boyfriend hanging out in Santa Cruz, California, at the boardwalk there, having a great time. So, It's a great feeling. And then what she did also, she was willing to come to Stanford. The Stanford women's basketball team had a donor appreciation night. And so she and I went down onto the court at halftime or something, and we presented a basketball to her that was signed by the coach, who happens to be one of the winningest coaches in NCAA history. So it was a really nice event. So she continues to embrace life. So it's really great to see.
Yes, truly amazing. And it's really like emotional and inspiring. And that's like really what medicine's all about. And I can't imagine how you feel about that for every patient, how much they recover through this process and start actually doing well in society. And so the wait for an adult liver transplant can feel endless, and sometimes patients don't really make it, which is truly sad. What do you think truly raises public awareness, and why do you think you should inspire more people to register as organ donors and help out?
Yeah, obviously, lots of efforts have been made in this, and there's publicizing the really positive stories like this, I think, are important. Episodes like yours on podcasts are important as you reach out to people, and simply putting your name on the donor list that you're willing to be a donor when you pass away. It's a way of communicating to your loved ones, right? That if I pass away, I would love to live on through my organs with someone else, or so I think publicity like that is important. It's a very public field, so sometimes there's news articles out there that are more negative, and sometimes those become inflammatory. So I think it's important for the community to counter those and point out that yes, there's some sort of scary stories out there. But those are exceptions to the rule, and really, there's so many people in this field that are incredibly dedicated to maximizing the gift of life, which is a donated organ, and sort of getting that message out is not straightforward, but it's super important.
And to our listeners, I mean, you heard it straight from a doctor who specializes in this field. So organ donation is definitely a very important topic and should be brought to more attention. And you should definitely donate something, even if you get the chance to, for sure. Now we're kind of shifting on to innovation and like the future. So robotic or minimally invasive liver tr surgery, specifically, in like li liver transplantation. Is it worth the trade-offs? And where is it not worth the trade-offs? And is it actually genuinely useful today in society? Because I know a lot of people think that robotic surgery is like scary and we're getting like replaced by AI, but from your perspective.
Yeah. So what we call robotic surgery now really is somebody controlling a machine very explicitly, right? It's not autonomous. It's not in any way like co-pilot or something thinking on its own at this point. Although I wouldn't be surprised that happens in the future or near future even. Some of the benefits of using robotic surgery, it's a little bit like high-level laparoscopic surgery, which laparoscopic surgery is when you make small incisions and you can insert cameras into the abdomen and instruments to the abdomen through those small incisions and do a lot of your surgery that way. And there's been a lot of progress in that over the last 25 years. Robotic surgery is sort of high-level laparoscopic surgery where you can be more precise and get better visualization and maybe even more complex tools to allow you to do that. So I think there's definitely a place for it. There's a few places in transplant. One is in removing kidneys from living donors. We at Stanford, we my partner Dr. Pham does robotic nephrectomies, donor nephrectomies, that's called. And he can keep the incision small and remove that kidney in a very safe way. He is planning to do robotic kidney transplants where he's going to implant the kidney into a patient. The patients thought to benefit from that the most are patients that are heavier with, where they have a higher rate of wound infections because of their obesity. And so you can make smaller incisions, have less chances of wound infections possibly by doing those patients with a robotic implantation. In liver transplant, I think I see one of the most useful places for robotic use is in the living donor hepatectomies. That's when we take out like the left lobe of a living donor using the robot. Again, the robot allows you to operate in a very precise fashion and you can use a lot of extra tools like ultrasound and instruments that are very specific for cutting through liver tissue. And you can do that out of a very small incision so that the donor recovers much faster than they would if you make a big incision to do the operation. The next step is, can we do the liver transplants with a robot? And my other partner, Dr. Kazu Sasaki, has done two of those in this past year. The benefit there, again, is using a smaller incision, and hopefully the recovery time is faster. I think there's a lot of work in sort of figuring out the best way to do these. So it may take some time to really maximize that. But we always do want to step back when you have new technologies here. The robot does require more expense. Is it really making a big difference? And in some cases, you don't know until you really use it a lot and figure out how best to use it. So I think there is a lot of work to be done there still.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that technology is rapidly changing the field, and it might be getting more available in the future. And so as the chief of the transplantation, do you decide whether technologies to bring in practice first? And if you do, how do you test what's really worth it?
Yeah. So yeah, I do have the opportunity to have a lot of influence on what technologies we use. And you want to make sure you're using technologies not just because it's new technology. You want to make sure that it's cost effective, and you want to make sure, perhaps most importantly, that it's safe. So the gold standard criteria, of course, is randomized controlled trials, right? Where you compare one technology to another technology, you randomize it so you're less biased than who gets either technology, and you determine which is better. Those are turns out be very difficult to do on a large basis for a lot of new technologies. So you have to really rigorously do it. Just by looking at case by case and being honest with yourself. So you need to, I think it requires honesty, self-reflection, and careful assessment of what you're using. So one of the new technologies that's been widely adopted now are these perfusion pumps, which you place organs on and they perfuse sometimes oxygenated blood through the organ, the liver specifically. And you can preserve the liver for a long time period. So normally on ice, you kind of want to use the liver by 10 hours or so after it's been ice. But if you put it on one of these pumps, it can last 36 hours and maybe even longer. It turns out they're extremely expensive. And so we had a lot of debate on should we be using these pumps or not. What we did at Stanford was initially we said, okay, we want to use the pumps, but we only want to use the pumps on livers that we wouldn't have used before because they'd be on ice too long or they might be fatty livers. The beauty of these pumps is you can actually run blood tests while they're on the pump and you can see if the liver's working. So we put a lot of these livers on pumps. We saw that they are working. We felt a lot more confidence putting the patient through the risk of the surgery by that it would work because the blood tests look good. So this has really changed how we operate and allowed us to do a lot more transplants over the last 2 years than we would have before. But we did it systematically. We didn't jump right into it. We did it step by step, progressively, sort of pushing the envelope a little bit more and more. And as we saw, wow, this is really working well. It really makes a difference. We were a little bit more aggressive and a little bit more aggressive and sort of figured out where we can go then. Because the danger always is you can be more aggressive to help more people, but then you might hurt somebody, right? So we're trying to figure out who best benefit and how many people we can benefit. But you have to weigh that against the cost, and so you can't just use it on everybody.
Yeah, for sure. And so now we're moving on to like training-based personalized questions. And for anyone that's looking or listening to this podcast because they want to become a future transplant surgeon, what does the road actually look like, and how did yours change or look like?
So I had a little bit of an indirect road. The road is long. So I think my first advice is to make sure that you really enjoy the training part. Enjoy the road as you go. It's not going to be easy. It's a lot of work. But boy, if you're not enjoying every step of the way, you might not enjoy the end of the road either. So I think be honest. Again, you got to be honest with yourself. Like, you want to be doing this because you enjoy it, not because someone else is telling you should do it, right? So generally, after college, you go to medical school. After medical school, you do training. And as a transplant surgeon, the training starts with general surgery training. General surgery training is usually 5 years of clinical training, and at most of the big academic centers, you also squeeze 2 years of lab research or research training in there. After you finish your general surgery training, you do 2 more years of a transplant fellowship, transplant surgery fellowship, and then you can finally become an attending and work. I did a little bit. My indirect course was I initially was planning to go into basic science research. So after college, I went and did a PhD in molecular biology. And then, even though I liked what I was doing, I didn't love it as much as I was working. And I was working really hard, but I liked it, but I didn't love it. And I figured if I'm going to do something where I'm working this hard, I better make sure I love it. So I went to med school, which was a great decision. In med school, I fell in love with surgery, which intimidated me at first. I have to be honest, it intimidated me going into that, but I'm so grateful that I stuck to it and did that. And then transplant's just been a great match for me. So super fortunate enough that I'm here where I am.
That's amazing. And so for all the doctors who became what they are today, they've always had mentors and role models. So is there anybody who helped shape you and what they teach you about medical school that it didn't teach you that?
Yeah, so I think no doubt where you end up and what you end up doing is determined by the people around you and the people you admire and stuff. So I still remember the day I was interviewing for surgical residency. I was interviewed by Dr. Carlos Esquivel, who was chief of transplant at Stanford at the time. And I was just incredibly impressed with what his priorities were, his dedication to transplant, his hard work ethic, all those things. And I real and but with a sense of humility and not complete hubris, where I interpreted some other people and other specialties as having hubris. So I really appreciated that in him. And I've been so lucky. He's the one who hired me in my first faculty job after finishing my training. In some ways, I'm stepping into his shoes now, being chief of the division that he used to be the chief of just a couple of years ago. So, Dr. Esquivel definitely is one of these people. I also, during my transplant training, I did my training up at UCSF for transplant specifically, and Dr. Nancy Asher and Dr. John Roberts there are just phenomenal leaders, people I totally admire. And I'm still in touch with them and really grateful that have run across their paths, over time. So definitely a lot of mentors along the way and very grateful for that.
Obviously, the path to where you are now is very, very long. And everyone knows that medicine is a journey where you never really stop learning. And so throughout this very long and difficult journey, how did you continue to have the motivation to continue working forward and forward and not getting burned out by all the work and the learning and just everything you do?
It's an incredible feeling to work for 24 hours straight and walk out of the hospital knowing that you were involved in someone's really important care the night before. When I was a general surgery resident, I would remember going home after operating all night on, perforated bowel or something, and walking out of the hospital and saying, "Wow, that's pretty awesome that I was able to be part of that." This happened to me recently, just in transplant. We were involved in transplanting a child with liver. It required my whole team to be involved. There was three or four surgeons involved, plus working with anesthesia and hepatology. And then walking out of the hospital the next morning, it's this great feeling. The surgery went well. The patient was going to the ICU in a good starting position. You got to step back and appreciate those moments. You also have to for not forget about the rest of your life, right? So you can't ignore the rest of your life. You have to take care of yourself. You have to work on your relationships. My wife is actually in transplant also. She's a transplant hepatologist. So we both have a very good understanding of what each other's stressors are in the world. And we respect that and respect each other, what our expertise is. And I would say that that's been super important. So working on relationships like that, I got kids, my relationships with my kids are important. Getting some time away, getting for me, I'm lucky I'm near the coast. Getting to the coast is a great thing to get away. So maintaining some sense of balance, although it's really hard to say that I have a balanced life.
For sure. And within your busy life, look to end on a lighter note, after all these years saving lives, leading teams, is there any book that reminds you why you do what you do, or one that really stuck with you throughout all the years?
The person who's sort of considered the father of liver transplant, Tom Starzl, he has a book that he published many years ago, sort of an account of that and what he went through to do start transplantation in livers. It's called The Puzzle People. It's a book that talks about the start of transplant. We couldn't do that today. It would be almost impossible because they had so many people that died from the transplant at the time of transplant. And now it's become standard of care, and just the what they went through to make this happen, and now it's affecting thousands and thousands of people in a very positive way. But boy, it was tough when they first started. So there's that book. There's other books that talks about the backstories in transplant. But I like reading other books too. And there's so many cool professions out there, and people contributing to the world in different really positive ways. So I don't watch many medical shows. I can't watch those. Just it's too much like work, too much. I have real stress like that. I don't need extra stress like that.
We've definitely heard that before.
Yeah.
To end off today's episode, what advice do you have for anyone looking to join the medical field?
I think I'd similar advice that I've already given. Make sure it's what you want to do. Be willing to really investigate and look for opportunities to shadow doctors so you can really learn about what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. Keep your mind open about what specialties you're interested in. There's no reason that when you're going to med school that you should know that you're already going to be a surgeon. Keep your mind open to all the possible specialties out there. It's such medicine, one of the beauties of medicine, it's so broad. There's so many different ways that you can make medicine part of a medical career, part of your life. And even within surgery, I a lot of my schedule is tough to control because I have to work when the donors become available. Other surgeons have worked just as hard, but they have more control over their schedule. So it depends how you work and what type your mindset is, what works best for you. So keep an open mind to all the different possibilities to really try to find the one that matches you the best. And really make an effort to enjoy the path along the way. Because, if you don't enjoy it and you spend 12 years of your life training to be a doctor, that's 12 years of life that you didn't enjoy. That's life's too short. You really make an effort to find the joy in what you're doing.
Wonderful. So, Dr. Melcher, thank you so much for being on today's episode. And today's conversation was a reminder that every transplant is more than just a surgery. It's a second chance for someone to live fully again and to return to family dinners and pursue passions and reclaim the life that they thought they'd lost. So, again, thank you so much for being here today and giving us an inside look on how liver transplantations work.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be with you guys. I really
Okay.
appreciate this.
Thank you.
Great work.
Thank you so much, and keep on listening next time.